So this is work done. There's some very recent work done together with my student Matthew Killey and the number of others that was published earlier this year. And it's trying to understand two questions. One is sort of what happens if you have magnetic fields and bosons moving in the presence of a magnetic field, some fluxes, and you know, how do you detect currents, and you know, what happens, what kinds of interesting physics can one get from these kinds of states. So just to step back, we all know what happens if you have bosons moving on a lattice in the presence of strong interactions, right? So if you have, as Patrick mentioned, bosons have just two choices. One is you can either form a superfluid, you can Bose condense and form a superfluid, or you can have a gapped state, which is like an insulator for these bosons. And you tune between sort of these two phases, a superfluid phase and an insulating phase, by tuning the repulsive Hubbard interaction for these bosons. And of course, for bosons, you can have any number of integer number of particles in an insulating state. So there are multiple Mott insulating lobes that can occur. So this is all well known and goes back to work in the late 1980s. But there's very nice experiments about 10 years ago showing that one can actually realize this most directly using atomic gases. So if you have these cold bosonic atoms in an optical lattice formed by counterpropagating lasers, then you can, in fact, start from a state which is a superfluid where, in the absence of a lattice, the bosons condense at zero momentum. You turn on the lattice, and the lattice causes the states at k equal to zero to Bragg scatter into states at the reciprocal lattice vectors of the lattice, giving you a superfluid but with extra peaks in the momentum distribution. And finally, if you make the lattice very strong, you can get into a state where the system is insulating and hence shows no condensation at all in the momentum distribution plots. There's, of course, similar Mott transitions that people have thought about earlier. So for instance, in the context of Joule-Wilson junction arrays, where you can fabricate superconducting islands and make them form some kind of a periodic array, one can look at this kind of a transition simply by looking at transport measurements of resistance versus temperature, where different island sizes give you different results. So if, for example, the Joule-Wilson coupling is comparable to or larger than the charging energy, you end up with a superfluid state or some kind of state where the resistance drops to zero as you cool the system. Or you could get insulating states where if the island is small so that there's a large charging energy for these islands, then you can actually end up getting an insulator. And so you can tune through this by actually looking at different samples with different sizes for these superconducting islands, and one can make a plot of the phases of the system as a function of the Joule-Wilson coupling to the charging energy, sort of the Joule-Wilson energy to charging energy ratio. And again, you find two phases as seen directly from here, namely one where it's a superfluid, it's an insulating phase here and a superfluid phase there. So what people have done recently is to go beyond this and to ask whether one can actually put in magnetic fields into the system. Okay. And this kind of a challenging problem, because you have to now do this for these neutral particles, right? So you want to get an orbital magnetic field in from these neutral objects. And so what they appeal to is the fact that some of these atoms actually have internal states, so-called hyperfine levels. And you can actually couple this internal spin state to the orbital degrees of freedom by driving Raman transitions. So you can actually take Raman transitions between, let's say, two different hyperfine levels where you absorb and re-emit a photon, except unlike in the case of solids, the momentum transfer is actually quite significant in these for these systems. So unlike in a solid where one thinks of Raman scattering as a Q equal to zero probe of excitations, here one can actually get momentum transfers that are significant on the scale of the lattice constant. And what this does is it rearranges the dispersion of these levels so that instead of three parabolas, which are shown here in gray, you can actually mix these levels by using this laser. And the lowest dispersing parabola here actually gets shifted from having a minimum at k equal to zero to having a minimum at finite k. And that is really like applying a vector potential. So instead of k square, you get k minus a whole square, which shifts the minimum from being here to being there. Okay, so what you can show is you can use this to generate vector potentials. And what the experimentalists at NIST and at Munich and others, like Bloch, Spielman, and others have done, is to really use this, and this from the Spielman group, is that you can actually use this idea to create non-uniform vector potentials as well. And what that gives you is magnetic fields where if you look at the Bose condensate picture, you begin to see vortices induced simply by this Raman process. Okay, so you can sort of go beyond making uniform vector potentials and actually create magnetic fields, orbital magnetic fields for these neutral particles. And so now this opens up a whole host of interesting questions. And in particular, I'll look at some physics of lattice systems where, you know, people have put in various flux patterns. So this is very recent work from Emmanuel Bloch's group where you can actually pattern fluxes on a lattice where they have, let's say, a flux phi on every plicket of the lattice here, a flux minus phi on every plicket here, flux phi. So it's like a stripe arrangement of these fluxes. And they can actually go in and look at the momentum distribution of the superfluid. And you see all these extra spots that appear, which are a consequence of the fact that the dispersion of particles in the presence of such fluxes has multiple minima. Okay? So one can create these fluxes. One can probe the superfluid phases arising in the presence of such fluxes. And the natural question that one asks, I mean, are there analogs of this? And what interesting physics is there coming out of this? And so again, one can sort of go back to old work on Josephson junction arrays, where, for instance, people have applied fluxes in Josephson junction arrays. And one very qualitative distinction that arises, for instance, if there is a flux of no flux at all present, which is the plot we saw earlier, where you have a superfluid to insulator transition as a function now of the charging energy. So this is sort of the reversed axis with respect to what I was showing you earlier, where this is the superconductor at small charging energy and the insulator at large charging energy. If you put in a flux, qualitatively, it looks like there is something similar, there is a superconductor and insulator, but quantitatively, for instance, there is a change. For instance, here the transition happens at about 2, here the transition happens at a much smaller value of the charging energy. So superfluids where you have fluxes present in the system, actually it's easier to drive them Mott insulating. And that's not hard to imagine because if you think of, you know, this problem of particles moving on a lattice in the presence of fluxes, this is Hofstadter problem, and what happens is the system breaks up into multiple bands. And I don't know if people have seen this picture of the butterfly and so on. So this sort of very complex band, but the lowest band tends to effectively reduce the bandwidth. And that means it's easier to drive the system insulating. And that's roughly what's being seen here. Okay. So the rest of this talk, I'm going to really try and focus on two important questions in the context of these cold atom systems. One is, you know, there are all these currents that are supposed to flow in the presence of such orbital magnetic fields. So is there a direct way to see such currents, given that these are neutral particles? Right? So I can't go in and look for magnetic fields produced by these currents. So how do I look for them? And the second is, if I take magnetic fields and actually go to a strongly interacting regime, right, what happens to the physics of Mott transition that we saw in the earlier case? Okay. So the basic idea that we're going to use to think of current probes is the following. So imagine I have an equilibrium current carrying state, okay, with steady currents on a lattice, right? Then we know that every lattice point, you're going to have the condition that the current that's entering that point is equal to the current leaving that point, okay? And now if there is any way to disturb this condition, what you're going to get is a buildup of the density of particles, okay? And people have very nice ways to go and probe densities now. So these experimentalists who can do these cold atom experiments can go in situ into the lattice and basically do some analog of microscopy to go and look at atom number side by side. And so they have very good ways of measuring densities. And so the idea then is to use density measurements as a way to sort of infer currents present in the system. Okay. Right, so what do we actually do? So here is just a couple of examples that I'll discuss, and then I'll move on to the strong correlation problem. Okay. So imagine I have a particles, you know, hopping, like, you know, this kind of experiment that I was just showing you from Emmanuel Bloch's group, where I have bosons which are weakly interacting now. So this U is there, but it's not strong. And I have some hopping, which in general includes fluxes. What you're going to get is, and imagine I take a staggered flux case just as an example, where flux phi and minus phi are arranged on in a checkerboard pattern. And this is some trap potential, which is not important for really important, aside from, you know, making pretty pictures like this. So what you get is that you can find the ground state of this system at, you know, just a simple mean field like level where you do like Hartree type theory. And what you find is that the density sort of falls off as you go from the center of the trap to the outside, which is not surprising. And what you do not see, however, is the fact that there are these staggered currents that are produced in the superfluid because of these fluxes. Okay? So the question is, how do you measure these currents? And the simple idea in this case is to actually imagine I change the hopping along one direction to be smaller than the hopping along the other direction, which is very easy to do in these systems because you can turn up the laser intensity, and what that does is it suppresses tunneling. So if you suppress tunneling, imagine I suppress tunneling in the y direction, and let's say I look at this central row here, what you conclude is that the currents there must become smaller instantaneously, but the currents along the x direction are not affected. Okay? So what this means is that you will see that at this point here, there will now be more current flowing in than is flowing out. But if I go to the next point here, there's more current flowing out than is flowing in. Okay? So what this means is if I look at the system a little time later, and the way we do this is to sort of look at a time-dependent, you know, Gross-Pitevsky type formulation, but one can do more different calculations with this. One sees that this kind of current pattern immediately translates after a very short time interval into a checkerboard density pattern, which is very easy to measure. Okay? And what the system does as a function of time, there are two checkerboard patterns, and what the system does is something like a plasma oscillation between these two checkerboards. Okay? So it's a very simple way to actually measure currents, which is to try and disturb the system and then try and look at densities. And one can sort of use this as a tool. And so just as another example, we've done this for fermions. Okay? And for fermions, it's kind of an even simpler problem in a way, because for fermions, you can go to momentum space, let's say in this case, forget about the trap. If you go to momentum space, what you get is a spectrum which has two bands because of the fact that you've doubled the unit cell. And this process where you change the tunneling from being isotropic to being anisotropic is really, you can think of it in momentum space like a spin problem, right? So you have some pseudo spin, which is these two bands. And what you do when you quench the system is you change the magnetic field. Okay, and the dynamics then is simple spin precession dynamics of electrons at a certain momentum state can sort of spin precess between two possible bands. And what we find is, again, that the difference between the density on the A sublattice and the B sublattice, you get sort of oscillations. Okay, the oscillations are more complex structure here. As a function of time, if you see the sublattice, it has slightly more complex structure than the simple one I showed you earlier, because there are many, many momentum states. Okay, so there are many, many oscillation frequencies. But it turns out that in this particular problem, as a matter of detail, it turns out that there are Van Hoff singularities in the band structure, and they actually control sort of a dominant oscillation frequency actually given by that. And so, in fact, one can read off the dominant oscillation frequency as some very simple analytical form that depends on the hopping and the flux that you put in. Okay, so in particular, one can use this as a measure of the flux if you didn't know what the flux was. So we've done this for a number of other cases. We looked at the striped flux superfluid that Emmanuel Bloch's group has produced. And one can actually use this kind of exact same thing to look at edge currents in a quantum Hall system. So if you have chiral edge currents, you can actually go and do these quenches and look at the dynamics of the charge and show that there are actually these chiral edge currents present. Okay. So what I want to turn to in the next 10 minutes is really look at the physics going beyond this very simple weakly interacting regime to ask what happens if you look at the Mott transition physics. Okay, what happens to the Mott transition? And so this, what we've looked at is in a two-leg ladder where we've been able to do very careful numerical calculations using multiple techniques to nail down the phase diagram. But the idea is that every plecat here will now have flux, and in particular, we looked at the simplest case where the flux just takes on a value equal to pi. And if you have a pi flux in every plecat, then the band structure splits from being, so imagine the absence of flux, you had this one simple cosine-like band. Now you get two cosine-like bands which mix and split and give you this two-band problem with two minima. And so if you look at bosons, the bosons would prefer to condense, either here or there or in some linear combination. And what interactions do is that they, in fact, force the bosons to condense into a linear superposition with equal weight here, but with a relative phase that's non-trivial. So I'll sort of come to that. And the resulting state at weak interaction is just a superfluid where the currents are propagating in this checkerboard fashion, but now the symmetry is spontaneously broken. Okay, so as opposed to the earlier case where I was talking about fluxes which produce currents, here, because it's pi flux, you can have this pattern where this particular plecat is either going clockwise or counterclockwise. And so there are two different patterns for pi flux for the superfluid. Okay. All right. So this is the superfluid state. And one can sort of write down, go beyond what words that I just said, and one can write down a simple Landau theory-like description where you say that, look, I have two different minima, and I can write down a theory that involves the fields where I have bosonic fields at k equal to 0 here and k equal to pi. And it turns out that, to fourth order, the important term that's present here is that you want equal amplitude on these two, and then there's a term which is like an umklap-like term which scatters, you know, takes two particles, two bosons here, and can scatter them from this valley to this valley. And what that produces is a relative phase of plus or minus pi by 2. Okay, so it forces a certain phase locking between these particles, which spontaneously breaks time reversal symmetry. So you have to either pick plus pi by 2 or minus pi by 2, and that gives rise to either currents on a given plaquette going clockwise or counterclockwise. Okay, all right. So that's the weakly interacting regime, and the question is what happens in the strongly interacting regime. Okay, so if you think about what I said earlier in the context of Josephson junction, if I zero flux, then I know that I have a simple Mott transition where I go from superfluid to Mott insulator. And if I have this chiral superfluid, what I'll call a chiral superfluid, basically it's this superfluid with staggered currents, then if you do simple mean field theory, what you find is that this chiral superfluid becomes a Mott insulator, but there is the only change that happens in mean field theory is that the location of the transition becomes moves to smaller interaction. So it's easier to drive the system insulating because of the smaller bandwidth of these bands here. Okay? Effectively, you've chopped the bands into two, and you get a smaller bandwidth. Okay? But if you go beyond mean field theory, you find that, in fact, you know, you would expect that, in fact, this can't really be true in general, right? Because you have a state here that spontaneously breaks time reversal symmetry as well as it has superfluid order. And so, in fact, it's very strange to find a single transition that directly separates this from a conventional Mott insulator where there is no order of any sort. And so the question was to go back and see whether if one can do something beyond mean field theory to try and understand what happens in the vicinity of this point here. Okay. So the model here is just one which where you have hopping, you know, along the chain, interchain hopping, and a Hubbard repulsion. And we go beyond mean field theory using two different approaches. So one is that if you realize that these fluxes that you put in are really fluxes that live on the spatial plaquettes, then in fact you can go to the phase representation and this kind of an unfrustrated problem. So you can really think of this like I can line up ladders along the time direction, imaginary time direction, and think of this as a two-dimensional XY model that I can do numerics on just using classical Monte Carlo. And the other is we've actually used DMRG numerics to directly study the boson problem. So you might say that this is something that's valid at large fillings where I can really think of it just like a phase-only kind of model. And then here you sort of take into account all the degrees of freedom for these bosons. Okay. So what do we look at? So to imagine, so this is a system which is in one dimension in the quantum problem or a two-dimension classical problem. And so if you want to ask where you lose superfluidity in the system, it's typically through a Kosellitz-Thouless transition, right? And so if you want to look at that, you can't look at an order parameter. You have to actually look at the superfluid density or what's called the helicity modulus, which is like the superfluid density, and ask how that changes as you crank up temperature or interactions, really, okay? Or temperature in the 2D problem or interactions in the 1D problem. And what we find is that the superfluid density sort of falls precipitously as a function of this parameter here. Okay. So it looks like a Kosellitz-Thouless in the sense that it looks like it wants to go and jump here, right? But one can do a slightly better job, and in fact, one can fit the helicity modulus to the form that one expects from a Kosellitz-Thouless transition, and one can actually unequivocally show that this is, in fact, a KT transition. Okay, so you can look at the scaling of the finite size scaling of the helicity modulus, in fact, then can show that that this agrees with what you expect for a KT transition. Okay? So we expect that superfluidity in the system disappears to a Kosellitz-Thouless transition. Okay? But I told you that there was the current order that was present, which had these counter-circulating currents on adjacent plaquettes, and the question is how does that go away? Okay? Or where does it disappear? And to do that, we realize, in fact, this is kind of a discrete broken symmetry. So in fact, it's expected to survive as a broken symmetry even in one dimension in the quantum problem. And so in the 2D classical problem, what this means is you heat the system up, this Ising-like order will actually survive even at finite temperature. And so one can sort of use binder cumulants to nail down the transition. So you look at some ratio of order parameter moments, and you find that there is a crossing point that indicates the location of this transition. And the susceptibility in the vicinity of this point is actually very nicely obeys sort of the Ising exponents in this particular case. So in fact, one can come up with a phase diagram now where if I turn off the interchain coupling, then it becomes two decoupled one-dimensional problems where you have just a single Mott transition between an ordinary superfluid and an ordinary Mott insulator. But the moment you put in interchain coupling, it looks like you actually have three phases in the system. One is a superfluid which has staggered currents, which becomes non-superfluid, becomes an insulator through a Koslitz-Thouless transition, where these staggered current patterns actually survive. Okay, so it's a weak insulator of the sort that Patrick talked about when he was mentioning the organics. It's a weak insulator, so there are charge fluctuations which are important here, but you have spontaneously broken time reversal symmetry where you form current patterns that can actually survive and have this kind of long-range Ising order. And finally, of course, when you go to the very strong repulsive limit, in fact, you don't care about fluxes. You just nail down one boson to every site, or you have an ordinary paramagnet in the language of these XY spins. Okay. So there's this intermediate sliver, which is, it's sort of like this, it's somewhat similar. It's kind of reminiscent of the phase that one finds in the organics, where there is some intermediate phase which is stabilized by charge fluctuations, which is absent in the very strongly interacting the strong coupling limit. Okay. So we've done DMRG numerics as well, and there one can use the momentum distribution and its scaling behavior where you know that a Koslitz-Thouless transition, there is some universal power law, and one can sort of use that to nail down the KT transition by looking at the momentum distribution at k equal to zero. And one can do very similar, you know, structure factor analysis to nail down the point where the Ising order disappears. And again, the phase diagram that we find is completely consistent. So the shape changes because clearly it's a different model. But we find three different phases with this intermediate chiral Mott insulator that actually has these current patterns. Okay? So if you think about this in terms of if you really want to think about this like a magnetism problem, it's actually the closest analogy is like a spin one magnet, where if you think of the Mott insulator as having, you know, particle number n equal to 1 or 0 or 2, you can think of this like a spin one particle where you have Sz equal to minus 1, 0, 1. And the state, the Mott insulator state, is then just a state where you have the easy plane kind of anisotropy where you go into the Sz equal to 0 state instead of plus minus 1. So that's a unique ground state there. These superfluid states that you get, or this Mott insulator, correspond to actually developing two different types of orders starting from the Sz equal to 0 state. So the first step that you do is you want to develop some kind of vector chirality. Okay, and this vector chirality is, it's different from the scalar chirality that Patrick was mentioning, but basically it's like saying that there is S cross S is like a current of these bosons, and so you get something like vector chiral order followed by actual ferromagnetic power law correlations on top of that vector chiral order. So it's sort of like a magnetism problem if one can recast it like a spin one magnet. Okay, so finally, I'll just sort of give you a different sort of physical pictures for this directly in the language of bosons. So one is, you know, this chiral superfluid, one can really think of this like a vortex crystal, right? So you have every plaquette has pi flux, and so it'll spontaneously nucleate something like a vortex or an anti-vortex, okay? And you want to ask, well, if every plaquette wants to do that, how do I organize this along the ladder or in two dimensions? And a natural way to organize this is to say, because these are repelling, the vortices are repelling, you want to form some kind of an antiferromagnetic crystal, okay? And this antiferromagnetic crystal is sort of like this. It's a state where you have, you know, currents that run in the same direction, but on every other plaquette. If you want to think of the Mott insulator, ordinary Mott insulator, this is one where these vortices are so mobile that they actually phase disorder the superconductor entirely, or the superfluid entirely. Okay? So this natural intermediate state one can most naturally think of as a supersolid of vortices. Okay? It's a state where you make interstitials or vacancies in this vortex crystal, and then you allow them to become mobile. Right? So if they're very dilute, they're very few in number, they will phase disorder the system very easily, but they can't actually kill the background crystal. Okay, so this intermediate state one can think of in this language as a vortex supersolid. Okay? Or an alternative way to think about this is in terms of the excitations of the Mott state. So if I think of the Mott insulator, I can make particle-like excitations where I add charges, or I can take off charges and make hole-like excitations. And both these particles and holes will have some dispersion. Okay? And the dispersion looks exactly like the dispersion of the original particles that I talked about. So they have a gap to making these excitations because you're in the insulator, but the dispersion has these two minima, right? And you can really think of this like a semiconductor with having two valleys in the two sort of degenerate valleys. Okay? And a very natural intermediate state when you try to metallize such a semiconductor, right? So imagine you decrease repulsion and you want to make the semiconductor metallic. A very natural intermediate state is actually an exciton condensate. And in fact, this can be thought of as a bosonic version of an exciton condensate. So you can take a particle-like excitation from one minimum, a hole-like excitation from the other minimum, right? Both of these are gapped, right? But you can form bound states which actually become favorable things to create once you're close to the Mott transition. These are, in fact, the binding energy will sort of exceed the energy actually required to make these things. And you can see that this will break translational symmetry because you have two different momentum states that you're, you know, putting together and trying to condense. And you can choose the phase such that it reproduces the current pattern that I showed in the earlier case. Okay? So there's some very natural you know, ways to think about this intermediate state at strong correlations. And so it's kind of an indirect exciton condensate in some ways, analogous to things that people have thought about in semiconductor physics. All right, so just to conclude with some experimental signatures, if you do have such a intermediate chiral Mott state, it would appear as an insulator if you do transport measurements, but you actually produce spontaneous staggered magnetic fields that you can go and look with you know, microscopy, like doing magnetic microscopy. And in the case of cold atom systems, again, one would expect that there are no sharp peaks in the momentum distribution because there's no condensation in this Mott state. But you can do quench experiments to actually look for these currents of the sort that I mentioned in the beginning of the talk. Okay. So thank you for your attention.